17th of June. 18th. The 18th of June.
Yeah.
Is it the 18th?
It is indeed.
And 1998, and we are Gabby Dinman and Mary A. Harrison. We are interviewing Mr. Barry Paris at 5125 Baird Street in his home. And we're going to make a test. Barry, we're just going to start sort of in the very traditional way of just interviewing you. We're going to start out with your name, your age, where you were born.
Okay. And that is Barry Paris. It's B-A-R-R-Y. Paris, like France, one R. And I was born in Pittsburgh, February
6, 1948. Here we go.
Now my time.
You were born in?
1948.
In Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. McGee.
And your mother and father's name?
My mother, father's name is Wyoming Benjamin Paris, and my mother's name is Claire Gill Paris. She was also born and raised in lifelong Pittsburgh.
And you have brothers and sisters?
One brother and one sister. My brother, Wyoming Benjamin Paris, Jr., now lives in Maryland. He's an aeronautical engineer, and he was born in 1933. And my sister Pamela, who is in Kansas, who was born in 1941.
Okay. And could you tell me a little bit about your schooling?
I went to Turner. We lived in Wilkinsburg, so I went to Turner School in Wilkinsburg, grade school, and then Wilkinsburg Junior High. And then when I was 12, the family moved to Kansas because my father got a job out there. And so I went to a Jesuit Catholic high school in Wichita. And when I graduated from there, went to Columbia University in New York. I graduated from there in 1969 in Slavic languages as a Russian East European studies major. And film, Soviet East European film was my specialty.
And what did you do when you graduated from college?
Well, the first thing I did was to figure out how to get out of the draft and avoid Vietnam. And the only way I could do that was by teaching Spanish, English, and some others. I had a Catholic school in Wichita. I went back to Kansas and simultaneously became the film critic for the Wichita Eagle. So, and that was in 1969. And then my wife and I, Myrna is an opera singer, and but she was also a journalist, and we started our own newspaper called the Prairie Journal in Wichita in 1972, and operated it for several years, and then moved back to Pittsburgh so that we both had fellowships. She had a fellowship at Carnegie Mellon in the opera department, and I had one in Pitt in the Slavic languages department. In Ukrainian and Slovak. So we moved back here, and I vowed I'd never work for another newspaper. And 6 months later, when we spent all the fellowship money, I had to go back to the business set.
Doing what?
Film critic. Well, first as an editorial writer, and then as feature editor, and as film critic and music critic throughout the period, off and on. I had a checkered career at the Post because I was hired, fired, rehired, quit about five times between 1977 and last November, 97. I had been gone for 10 years, but we worked out a little arrangement, and I'm now back there on a part-time basis doing movie reviews.
Being a major of languages, Slavic languages, how did you become interested in film?
It's hard for me to even say which one came first. It was a chicken and egg because I'd always been interested in film. My mother was cultural person and made it a point to take my brother and sister and I to all manner of plays and concerts and films. And I just always remember movies being in our lives, and from the time I was 4 or 5, and I had always been interested in film. Actually, that came first. The Slavic language interest came a little later, partly through the family history, because the Parises had come from, it's in debate, but probably the Odessa area of Kiev, the Jewish section of Odessa, and probably spoke, well, they definitely all spoke multiple languages, as you know, European, but they spoke Yiddish in the home, Ukrainian outside. My grandmother, when they moved to, when they emigrated to the U.S., never did quite learn English very well. And but anyway, the Slavic languages were in the in my background, sort of, though I can't claim to have ever heard them spoken because both of my grandparents, Paris, has died before I was born. I never knew them.
When did they come to this country?
In my grandfather, Sam Paris, came first in, I think it was about 1898, and brought the wife over, who was not yet his wife, I don't really, yes, she was, in 1901 or 2. My father was born, he was the next to the last, well, one of the younger ones of nine. He was born in 1906. And he will tell you the great story of the legendary move to Wyoming from Pittsburgh. They were all in Pittsburgh, they being his father and mother and the six or so older brothers and sisters, when Sam, the father, got the bright idea of, probably because he read an ad somewhere for, you know, 140 acres for $2 out in Wyoming, and schlepped them all out to God's country in Wyoming. They took a train from Pittsburgh to Chicago, and then they had to take a wagon from somewhere like Milwaukee out to Wyoming, the Torrington area, and that was 1905. And they lived in a essentially the equivalent of a cave, kind of a dugout thing, which was not that uncommon, a sod thing that was built into a hill, dug out of a hill, near Torrington, Wyoming, which is fairly close to Laramie, but way out in the country. And there he had a sheep ranch on which they were all miserable, and moved back to Pittsburgh. The rest of the family did about 2 years later. My father has very few memories of Wyoming because he was back in Pittsburgh along with everyone else except Sam, the father, by the time he was three or four, by 1909. Sam stayed there and rarely came back to the family in Pittsburgh. He semi-abandoned the family, actually. The older kids always had a lot of hostilities toward him for that. And then to complicate the domestic situation, my father's mother, my grandmother, died when he was only 12, which would have been 1918. And so they were raised, here are these nine kids being raised by the older, the eldest daughter of them. His name was Jean, who really raised the family. They were essentially a kind of an orphan family. When the mother died, Austin, the father wasn't here, they were kind of distributed around to the older relatives.
And your father was one of the youngest,
yeah.
Not the youngest.
Mm-hmm. He was, I think, the second youngest.
Would you tell us how your father got the name Wyoming?
Yes, I will. It's a nice, simple story. They, it's not a very Jewish name. Essentially, they were decided to honor the New World by naming their son after this new state. And Wyoming, at that point, the state was only, it was admitted to the Union in 1890, so it's only about a 15-year-old state. And he was the first Jewish boy born in the state of Wyoming, which has been documented and authenticated by no less than the governor of Wyoming, who sent him a congratulatory letter on his 90th birthday, stating all that 2 years ago.
What was governor's name?
Oh, God, I don't know, but I'll get you a copy of the letter.
Okay.
I'll get you a copy of the letter. It's a very nice, we had a big party for him, and the Wyoming Historical Society has always been very interested in him, as you might imagine.
Now, in your family life, as you were growing up, were there any religious observances, and if so, what? If not?
There were a lot of religious observances in the Orthodox and unorthodox way, and most of them were unorthodox. And most of them were not Jewish. My mother was a very strict Roman Catholic, and from the Gill, good German Catholic family, actually Alsace-Lorraine, and there were nine of them, too. And there were nine Parises who were at least initially, very Orthodox Jews. My father, though, pretty much then and certainly now and through the years, was not a devout practicing Jew. He was an extremely strong vocal and verbal ethnic Jew, cultural Jew. Pro-Israel since 1948. Everything related to the culture and the ethnicity, but not much related to the religion. And actually, there was a domestic battle that was going on for about 40 years in my family, because he was also pretty anti-Catholic. And his family was, both families were shocked and horrified when these two people married each other in 1930. I mean, it was a scandal for both sides that this Jewish boy was marrying a Catholic, his family was outraged, and that this Catholic girl was marrying a Jew, her family was not pleased. And over the years, it was a problem between them, because she was very devout and he wasn't. And but there were, on the other hand, we the kids sort of took advantage to try to get the advantage of both worlds, of being both observing the Catholic and the. I never had a bar mitzvah. I was always really annoyed about it.
Never too late.
It's never too late. But there was conflict over that. A lot of conflict. Therein lay many tales. He could give you a lot more information about that. He's very open about it. Not a.
How did it make you feel, though? I mean, was it?
It was a stressful situation. They were both wonderful people, my parents, and treated each other and us beautifully all the time, except occasionally, if, you know, we would hear these terrible arguments on the subject of religion. I mean, and the Catholic religion was very oppressive and very superior and very dismissive, especially of Jews and Judaism, and that galled him, and he would frequently hold forth on the subject, shall we say. And also, the one saving grace, there were many, is that both of them had great senses of humor, and when the thing got to the flash point, they would usually resolve it by something funny. She would have, for instance, she had all these little statuettes around the house, you know, Catholic things like a bust of the Virgin Mary and this and that. And but she'd come home from church and find, you know, instead of a halo, there would be an onion slice on the top of it. My father would do certain sacrilegious things to the figurines, which we thought was hilarious. But even my mother had to laugh. But. And then he was a big, great reader, still is. He reads 5-6 books a week to this day. And I remember one day he came home with, and he was always buying books, of course, which is a great Jewish tradition, and not just buying them, but reading them. And one day he came home with the complete works of Thomas Paine, which is like 12 volumes of these books. Nobody reads the complete works of Thomas Paine, but he did, and found in one of them a great essay on Thomas Paine, who was a great anti-religionist, had done a great, huge essay on the fact how Mary could not have been a virgin because Christ had other brothers and sisters, which is quite clearly indicated in the New Testament, which in fact it is. The question is whether they came. And he had these sections all marked out, and my mother was furious about them, and it was a big, you know, it was a typical one of their go-rounds. But it also was kind of funny. There was an element of humor behind it all, but it was sometimes tense.
Did you make any changes in your parenting, or what you...
You mean trying to avoid some of these?
Yes.
Things? Well, the main one is, yes, my wife and I have never fought over religion. We don't fight about much of anything, but certainly not religion.
And your children, have they had any religious...
They have been raised. What religious training they have had has been due to my wife, not to me. And she was a born and raised Methodist, fifth generation Methodist from Kansas. But she was the celebrated mezzo soprano soloist at Shadyside Presbyterian Church for 12 years. And so the kids, and she also was a member of the church, and the kids were too. And to the extent that they have a religion, I suppose it would be that.
Interesting.
Although they too have an ecumenical bent. I mean, I've made sure they're certainly aware of their Jewish heritage, and they're extremely aware of the Catholic heritage because of all the other the relatives. Well, both sides, both the Jews and the Catholic side. So these kids are probably more mixed up than I was even, but they have at least a very open and tolerant view.
Tell us a little bit about your father and your mother, but your father, and since we came to you through Richard Rao, whose family started this, Enoch Rao's basketball team. Tell us a little bit about your father and his involvement.
I will.
He was a basketball player.
With the caveat that you can get a much better story out of him. However, you can get a much shorter story out of me. So in a nutshell, so you'll have the overview before you get the you heard that example of the details.
Yes.
This was somebody that he hadn't seen, heard, or talked about in 50 years. On the subject of the Enoch Rao Club and all the Rao family, he can go on for a long time. But essentially, he and his older brother Meyer, and I think even their older brother Mace, all had a tremendous skill at basketball. And of the three of them, my father was by far the star. He was the greatest. And from the age of 10 or 11 or 12, everybody knew it. And in those days, of course, this was long before the NBA, the organized professional basketball, the semi-professional leagues were sponsored by individual companies or philanthropists or sponsors of some kind. And they were forming a team, they being my father, I guess, and some of his pals, and they needed uniforms, they needed jerseys, and they didn't have any money, and nobody did in the hill, in the Jewish ghetto, in the teens. And but they knew, everybody knew about Councilman Rao, and his particularly kind, generous wife, his first name I can't remember, but this would be Richard's grandmother and grandfather. Enoch's wife. What was her name? This is where we need Wyoming instead of Barry. But he'll tell you. You have that anyway. Anyway, so he, as he tells the story, if I have it right, and took the streetcar out to Squirrel Hill to where they lived, and I think with a friend. He would tell you the name and age and size and height, and knocked on the door and asked to see Mrs. Rao, and she kindly allowed them to come in and seated them in her beautiful parlor, and they told her their story and made the request, and she came through. She said yes. And so I know that's how they got the uniforms, and I think that's how they got the name. They took the name Enoch Rao Club in honor of their patron. And this was in the days of
Since you know you can read your father's writing better.
Oh yeah.
How about reading that?
Here's the story. Yes. Let's see how close I was. This is from Wyoming to Mary.
To Mary Harrison, I wrote him a letter a few weeks ago, and this is how he responded.
Yes, the Enoch Rao Club. He says, "I was one of four boys from the Hill District who originated the club. I was the one suggested Enoch Rao as the club name because of his respectful life and being the first Jewish councilman in Pittsburgh. Copying the use of well-known names for clubs, as did the members of the famous Coffee Club, that I try to emulate in all respect. Long story about Enoch Rao Club history and Mrs. Rao inviting us boys to her home in Squirrel Hill to listen to our idea of a club honoring the well-known, respected Enoch Rao." Excuse me. Another long story, but a quick answer. Well, for him, this is succinct. To the most important assumption, Mrs. Rao gave us a note paying for jerseys and shorts, nothing else ever. We financed ourselves by getting small fees for playing in many Pittsburgh areas, West Virginia, Ohio, Maryland, and the money from our own individual few dollars that we made working at various jobs. He worked in a parking lot downtown, I mean. Eventually, the club grew to 21 members. We did many good things in Pittsburgh. Example, besides winning city and county championships, we did things like entertainment for orphans in the various homes in Pittsburgh. Once, for about 3 years, with show people, etc., at the Oakland YMHA, lunch for them, gifts for the children. The Rowles, Mrs. Rowell and Dick Rowell, actually received the benefit of our newspaper write-ups, that's right, publicity he means, because even more well thought of, as the Rowell Club was more successful and became more newsworthy. So, contrary to some Pittsburgh thinking, the Rowells did not finance us beyond the original jerseys and shirts. Never any other donation. Oh boy, he's making that point. I'm smiling at myself remembering all this bygone history. I will show you pictures of the first Rowell Club basketball team, consisting of Shep Gevsky, Oscar Levine, Alex Singer. He doesn't mean Oscar Levine.
No.
He means another one. That's Kutsi, I think, maybe. No, I don't know. Mashie Wheeler, I love the name. George Levinson and myself. Hyman Gevsky was our first coach, 1919-1920. Dan Schmidt became our club leader and teacher. Underline are the original four boys invited to Mrs. Enoch Rowell's home in Squirrel Hill to discuss using the Rowell name for the club. And the four that are underlined are Shep Gevsky, Alex Singer, Mashie Wheeler, and Wyoming Parrot. We'll gladly give you much information answering all your questions and possible visit to Pittsburgh. May attend annual dinner indoctrination, etc. For the Jewish Sports Hall of Fame, Western Pennsylvania. Do you want me to read the rest?
No, unless you think that we should.
It's up to you.
The rest starts getting...
It's biographical.
Yeah.
How much more is there?
How
long did he go on?
No, he didn't go on. This is more... This well, is
if you want me to read it, I'll...
No, he sent a picture of your grandparents.
Oh, good, good. There they are. That's
yeah.
Sam.
Rachel and Samuel and... Yeah, okay. Now, I don't think you... I gave you that because I think...
Yeah, you wanted the Rowell information. I that's right, and I got it pretty close. And the reason he stresses the fact that they never got any... They never literally ever got any money. All they got was a jersey. But they made it into not only a self-sufficient thing that supported itself and supported them, and they in turn supported their families on this money. And it was like, would be considered a pittance today, but they would get a dollar or two for a game, and then when they started getting enough publicity that small crowds and then larger crowds were attracted, they would take a little bigger cut. Then, you know, they obviously had enough success money-wise to be able to do these charitable things to, you know, with orphans and buying kids. So this was a phenomenal, essentially, business that was invented and operated by a bunch of 12-year-old, or 13 or 14. He was the youngest. I think most of the others were older. He always lied about his age, but claiming to be older than he was when he was young and younger than he was when he was old. But they invented this thing, and it was very successful and very popular. I've shown you, and we'll talk about the clips later, the Mass Marvel thing. Was when he broke his nose in a game, and they fashioned this mask for him, the protective thing, out of the then new material of aluminum, relatively new, and it was a great invention. But the crowd liked it and started calling him the Masked Marvel. So we're sitting here looking at a 1927 Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph, a full-page newspaper spread of Wyoming as the Masked Marvel, and they liked it so much, the crowd, that he kept wearing it long after he really needed it. You know, he wore it for, it was needed for a couple of months, and then, you know, he was really better. But he kept wearing the mask because everybody liked it, until the other teams objected, and they claimed that it was, you know, a gimmick, and that...
Distracted from the game,
yeah, and that they could get injured by hitting his man. So they made him stop eventually. But he got a lot of mileage out of that.
What?
This is the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph of December 16th, 1927. And it's a photograph of him as he stood without the mask and then with the mask. And this, the big headline says, Masked Marvel.
But he has a shirt on that says Rowell.
Yeah.
That's important.
Very important. Okay, without this, guys, here's how why Paris looks without his trick disguise. The basketball player who is one of the best guards in the section was born in the plainlands of Wyoming and was named after the state. Looks, you know, it reminds me of Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs.
I told him about that too. Well, and here we are now, not 50, not 60, but 70 years later.
I have that picture.
You have that.
Yes, wonderful. No, give it to us if you'd like. I have it right here.
Well, you already have that. And here he and I are in Wichita a little while ago.
That's a wonderful picture.
It's a good one. But the point is that 70 years later, after this mass business, when he comes back here in November of 1998, which we hope he will do at the age of 92 for the Jewish Sports Hall of Fame event and other things, I'm making an appointment with him at the University of Pittsburgh School of Athletic Medicine. What's it called?
Sports medicine.
Craig and Baum. Because there are people there who are interested in the use of possible remanufacturing of this mask for other athletes in all sorts of sports who need it. This mask is something that is tremendously applicable for basketball, hockey, soccer, possibly even football. It has all sorts of applications. And there, I guess, have been things that are functionally similar to it in the 70 years in between, but nothing quite like this. So anyway, now he's all excited about the possible manufacture and adaptation of this mask by.
And what material would it be?
Well, he thinks it should be not aluminum now. He thinks it would be a form of fiberglass. He happens to be an expert at fiberglass constructions because of some other things that he's done. So that's a little up in the air. They haven't quite figured out what material would be, but he has some ideas, and he's going to develop them with them. So at 92, he's still being the entrepreneurial.
Your mother is not living.
No, she passed away about 4 years ago.
How did you? I realize you like journalism. You ran a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
What prompted you to become a biographer, and how do you choose your people? We have here Mr. Blaine, a fallen politician. Many years ago, and then we have Garbo, and we have
Hepburn, we have Louise Brooks. And don't forget Tony Curtis, my only Jewish subject. I wish there were a clear system to how I choose things. Some of them I choose, and some of them happen to me.
Like what?
Well, the first one that I chose, and my first love, was Louise Brooks, the silent film actress we have here. And that's because she was from Kansas, and her brother Theodore at the Wichita Eagle was my first editor and mentor, and said, if you call yourself a film critic, you better know something about Louise Brooks, my sister. And so 20 years later, I knew a lot about her and wrote the book. The second one was Garbo, and it's no secret why anybody would want to do a book on Greta Garbo. These books, both of those two, were for Knopf. The third one, and in some ways my not my favorite, but it was the most fun experience, was the autobiography of Tony Curtis. Now, you might think that Tony Curtis would have written the autobiography of Tony Curtis, but he didn't. I didn't. He spoke it, and not unlike what you're doing now, and I transcribed 80 hours of tapes, and with many, many revisions and rearrangements and other interviews, did his autobiography, which it's the only book I've done that hit number one on not the American but on the British bestseller list for 2 weeks in nonfiction, and has been translated into many languages. And Tony was in Pittsburgh, as a matter of fact, once for a fabulous historic meeting. Now, he came here because he wanted to see the house and where I wrote and everything. But when he was here, we had a little small gathering for him with just a few people, and one of whom was. It was in this room. He sat here. And over there sat his biggest fan, Sophie Maslow.
Oh!
And it was the most hilarious encounter. She came in and said, the first thing she said was, Tony Curtis, until Barry called me and told me you were here, I was just going to stay home and put my summer clothes in bags today.
I like it.
She so Sophie, and he was so charmed by her. I wished, and Myrna and I discussed it before and after. We wanted to tape it, and we wanted to take pictures, and we decided not to do either because we didn't want to be obnoxious. I wish I had. Because it was fabulous. And so Tony Curtis became a very good friend, and I still hear from him frequently. And I'll flip that off for a second, and I'll get you.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Please.
Are we on?
Mm-hmm. We're on.
We're on.
We're not going to be on long.
We'll turn it over now.
Well, just go ahead.
Okay. But I do also want to answer your nutshell question about how it got started. It's related. He was here when he was here, Pittsburgh. He wanted to see the room.